Hello and welcome. You're listening to Speaking of Urology, the official podcast for Urology Times. As always, our commitment is to deliver urologists and allied health professionals timely and informative insights from leaders in the specialty. Our exclusive interviews bring expert analysis, practice advice, and policy perspectives to help our listeners practice more efficiently. I'm your host and assistant editor, Hannah Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Ashish Kamat, who will be highlighting the state of bladder cancer in honor of Bladder Cancer Awareness Month this May. Dr. Kamat is a professor of urologic oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. He began the discussion by highlighting his own clinical practice and research interests.
Thank you for inviting me to be part of this podcast. My focus as far as my clinical practice and research portfolio is almost entirely devoted to patients with bladder cancer. And I see a very large number of bladder cancer patients every week, every month, every year, ranging across the different stages of bladder cancer, of course. A common theme of all my research and clinical endeavors has been bladder preservation, trying to get patients to hold on to their bladders as long as it's safe for them to do so.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Kamat. Moving into the space a little bit more broadly, could you touch on some recent advances that have been made in bladder cancer care?
There's been a lot of advances in the field of bladder cancer, both from the aspect of understanding the disease, understanding pathogenesis, diagnosis, treatments, and of course, molecular profiling and personalization of bladder cancer. I think one of the biggest advances we've made in a broad sense is understanding the mechanisms behind which bladder cancer not only develops but progresses. And because of that, there have been a lot more mechanistic-based treatments for bladder cancer across the different stages, not just in the early stages with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, where of course you can have FGFR-based therapies, or after BCG, where you can have immune-based therapies such as IL-15 superagonists and of course, the checkpoint inhibition, but also when it comes to muscle invasive and beyond. The checkpoint inhibition clearly has been a major advance with IOs, but ADCs such as EV and SG, which target specific surface molecules, are also very, very relatively new and have excellent results, both alone and in combination. And then, of course, the molecular sequencing and transcriptomics understanding and evolution has allowed us to gain further insight into hopefully what soon will be a much more personalized approach to patient care.
Great. Could you touch on how the BCG shortage has affected bladder cancer care in recent years?
The BCG shortage has been plaguing us for almost 10 years now. Really kind of hit North America in 2014. And it's a global issue, but it's not in all countries. So in some countries, there's plenty of BCG. Many countries, there's plenty of BCG, not just for bladder cancer patients, but also vaccination against tuberculosis. And in some countries like North America or our region, there's not enough BCG, even when you go from one state to the other, to take care of patients with bladder cancer. And because of that, unfortunately, across the globe, the incidence of patients who have to undergo radical cystectomy, which is really a life-altering procedure, has risen almost 300%, right? So in order to try and decrease that number and still allow sufficient patients to be treated with BCG, our group, several groups across the globe have come up with recommendations. And really, the way that has affected practice patterns is that we have started using reduced dose BCG. So long as you reduce it appropriately, does not affect patient outcomes as far as progression is concerned. There might be a slightly higher risk of recurrence, but if you explain it to patients and talk to them and say, hey, I can treat three people with a slightly increased risk of recurrence for you as an individual, it's the extremely rare patient that doesn't say that he or she would want to do that and help two other individuals rather than just, you know, have the whole full dose themselves.
Yeah, that was a great overview of that dilemma. Moving on to the recent AUA conference, which took place last month, Could you highlight some of the data on bladder cancer that were presented during that meeting?
The recent AUA at Chicago had a lot of interesting abstracts and sessions when it came to bladder cancer. One of the sessions that was really well attended and covered a lot of ground was the IBCG AUA Bladder Cancer Forum, which was held for the second year. And of course, that forum covered a lot of relevant but yet controversial topics and appropriately had both sides like debate-based management. So for example, one of the things that was discussed was the de-escalation of therapy for patients with intermediate-risk bladder cancer. You know, how much is too much and how much morbidity is justified in the setting of a tumor that might not progress. On the other hand, another debate that was really well attended and discussed was how do we treat patients with metastatic disease when it comes to local control within the bladder? So again, you know, that was a forum that was quite extensive, a little bit too long for me to cover right now in this podcast. But when it comes to data that was presented, that was actually novel and groundbreaking. Again, there was a lot of stuff presented in poster sessions, in podium sessions, but two that or three that garnered real attention was one, the presentation of the SunRISe-1 study, which was essentially using the TARIS platform and gemcitabine extended release. The other one was CG Oncology's oncolytic virus in combination with pembrolizumab, the results from that study, and then the extended data from the JAVELIN study, which was also presented at the meeting. So those three really were some of the highlights, but there's a lot of exciting work that was presented.
Great, and you mentioned the SunRISe trial, so could you highlight some of the specific data that were presented from that study and the implications that those findings might have for both patients and urologists?
The SunRISe platform of studies essentially utilizes Janssen's TARIS platform, which is a long acting gemcitabine formulation, mainly because of the slow release of gemcitabine from the device that can be instilled into the bladder. The SunRISe-1 data was presented by Dr. Danishmend on behalf of all the co-authors, and it was a relatively small number of patients, but so it has to be taken in that context, you know. But with the caveat that it was a small number of patients and a preliminary presentation, the complete response at any time, excess of 70%, was very, very exciting to see. Now, clearly, we need to see what the longer-term results are and what the results are when you have a larger cohort of patients. Because sometimes, you know, what you see in a small cohort may or may not pan out when you extend the number of patients being treated. But if these results do bear out in a larger population and longer study, most of us would be surprised if this does not become one of the approved options for our patients.
Great. Well, thank you for running through that in a little bit more depth. And then you also recently published a study on mental health illness in patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer, specifically looking at the role of BCG. So could you discuss a little bit more about that study?
Yeah, the study you're referring to, which looked at mental health illness in patients with bladder cancer and the role of BCG, was one that was spearheaded by one of our fellows here at MD Anderson, Valentina Grajales. And what we looked at in that project was essentially the impact of mental health on the ability of a patient to receive adequate BCG and also the effect of BCG on mental health, because there is sufficient data to suggest that immunization with BCG does have an effect on certain cognitive functions of patients, not just bladder cancer, but across the board. And there's ongoing research as to its protective effect on Alzheimer's disease, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, we all know that when patients are diagnosed with cancer, and in this case, bladder cancer, and if they have not just coexisting mental health issues, but mental health issues that develop because of the trauma, psychological and social, of having a cancer diagnosis, that might affect their ability to get adequate treatment. So in this study, what Valentina found was that both ways, there was an effect. In patients that had pre-existing mental health issues, their ability to receive adequate BCG was decreased. And that's an area of focus that's very much in need of us helping our patients with appropriate counseling. And on the other hand, there appeared to be some, and again, this is just correlative work, but some protective effect on the receipt of BCG on the subsequent development of mental health issues, at least as depicted by the coding, you know, that's reported out in these large data sets. So promising data, and again, an impetus for us to help our patients do better by virtue of counseling, for example, with the Beacon Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network and all the work they're doing. It really helps our patients, and I think this highlights that point.
Great. Well, that's really important work, so I appreciate you highlighting that study. Kind of looking more broadly, what advances are you anticipating in bladder cancer in the next few years?
I think the advances in bladder cancer that have already occurred are being accelerated. And in the next few years, I'm really looking forward to a culmination of efforts on the parts of multiple individuals and groups across the globe coming together and seeing the fruition of those developments. It's unlikely that there'll be any major new effort in the next 2 years or so, but there's so much that's ripe for being mature and being used in the clinic. For example, the appropriate subtyping of bladder cancer has now been a matter of discussion for almost a decade, and it just as always ends a discussion by saying it's not ready for prime time. I think in the next 2 to 3 years, there's enough momentum behind that and enough studies that are currently ongoing that hopefully should be read out that we will have an answer one way or the other. The same thing when it comes to sequencing of therapies. We're fortunate now that we have two drugs approved, for example, in the BCG unresponsive space. Hopefully, at least one, maybe two more approved in the near future. And if we have a excess of agents available, that's great for our patients. But the unmet need then becomes how do you appropriately help our patients make that treatment decision. And that's one of the reasons why the International Bladder Cancer Group is actually going to be meeting at the end of August to have a discussion and have some consensus guidelines on how to appropriately sequence patients for these treatments. So looking forward to that and a lot of other developments in the next 2 to 3 years.
You just heard an exclusive interview with Dr. Kamat on the state of bladder cancer today. Be sure to subscribe to Speaking of Urology on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps. You can get the latest in urology news, practice management advice, and health policy updates by visiting our website, urologytimes.com, or by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Urology Times. Thank you for listening.